It's our last class. There are a few things that I want to look at quickly, and then maybe a couple of things more slowly. Mainly, I hope we get to talk about Houseman today. But before we get to Houseman, one thing that I wanted to point you to is poem 502, which I keep looking at the page numbers. I think they do it by poem numbers so that when they reprint the book, they don't have to change that part, even if the page numbers are different. But if you go to page 568, it's the Yeats poem called Who Goes With Fergus. But since I mentioned when you were old, just look at the page before that, page 567. So this is a translation that Yeats did of a poem by the 16th century French poet Ronsard. Just worth looking at. When you're old and gray and full of sleep and nodding by the fire, take down this book. So it's meta, but not in a, oh, isn't it cool, that's meta way. But it's an expression of a hope. So here's a poem in a book. And he is saying to her, when you're old, take this book, read this poem. When you're old and gray and full of sleep and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once and of their shadows deep. So he knows the soft look her eyes have. He knows of their deep shadows because he sees them right now. And he says, so take down this book and dream of what I'm actually seeing. How many loved your moments of glad grace and loved your beauty with love false or true, but one man loved the pilgrim soul in you and loved the sorrows of your changing face. So that one man would be?
Who's Peter?
Yeah, Yeats himself, because it's really Maud Gonne. Do people know who Maud Gonne is? Do you know who Maud Gonne is? So Maud Gonne was the great love of Yeats' life, who they were friends. But she was a very well-known, active figure. And bending down beside the glowing bars, murmur a little sadly how love fled and paced upon the mountains overhead and hid his face amid a crowd of stars. So just read this poem, remember it. And just the thing to notice about it, because we're going to talk about some of this, a similar thing in Houseman, is that it is an anticipation of a recollection of the present moment. So it's think of the, when the future comes, when you look back now to now with melancholy and long for this moment with melancholy, then read this poem and feel the melancholy that I'm putting into it already, the melancholy that will be true in the future. So there's a way that that future melancholy is projected back to the present. It's not simply here we are, but it's let's feel this moment as having that kind of bittersweet richness that usually things only have in the past. But that's not to say let's do it in the present. It's let's already think of this moment as a moment in the past. Think of this poem as a poem written long ago, even though I've just written it. You can think a little bit that it's like the Stevenson's Tanny Reader. That is, that it's a child of air that lingers in the garden there. But what is that child reading? Reading this very poem. So there's a really interesting way in which these poems are about the future in which their time of writing will be remembered. and Yeats and Stevenson. It's a particularly moving and plangent quality that some of these poems have. And Houseman has it too. That's something we'll look at in Houseman. But I also wanted us to look at Who Will Go Drive with Fergus. That is the next poem. So Fergus, anyone know who he was? So he was a Celtic god, king, legendary figure, magician who was dethroned and became a kind of patron, supernatural, out at legendary leader of poets. So, and Yeats loved thinking about those things. He loved evocativeness. So, yeah.
I just think it's funny that I imagined Fergus was like an English bulldog. Very different poem now.
Yes. Okay. So, Who Will Go Drive with Fergus Now? That is in his chariot, in his car. Who will go drive with Fergus now and pierce the deep woods' woven shade and dance upon the level shore? So who will go with Fergus to dance on the shore? Young man, lift up your russet brow and lift your tender eyelids, maid, and brood on hopes and fear no more, and no more turn aside and brood upon love's bitter mystery. For Fergus rules the brazen cars and rules the shadows of the wood and the white breast of the dim sea and all disheveled wandering stars. So again, notice they both end with the word stars, when you were old, and who goes with Fergus. And it's very Yeatsian to say what you shouldn't brood on as a way of brooding. But it's a way of brooding that also gets transmuted, you could say. It's still brooding. No more turn aside and brood upon love's bitter mystery. Oh, okay, I won't then. Spending too much time brooding on love's bitter mystery, but now I'm going to do something cheerful. As soon as you say love's bitter mystery, the whatever alchemy is turning brooding into dancing on the level shore, it's not getting rid of the brooding, but it's a different kind of brooding. It's the brooding, you could say, of the just power, the pleasure that even sad poetry gives you, which is what a lot of the poets, especially Yeats and Houseman today, but a lot of Victorian poets do, but for today, it's Yeats and Houseman. The great French philosopher and critic Gilles Deleuze has an amazing sentence in an essay of him, an essay of his called Nomad Thought, where he says that there's an indescribable joy that always comes to us from the great books, no matter what they speak about, even if they are about sadness, horror, despair. And the idea of lyricizing things, you know, that's the pleasure we get from music, sad music too, but it's the idea of lyricizing things that Yeats is particularly interested in lyricizing that very idea. That's what poetry does, is it can do, it can lyricize things. And then the fact that it can do that is itself a lyrical fact, maybe you could say. At the beginning of Ulysses, which I've mentioned several times, the Joyce's novel, Stephen Dedalus, who is the character who's closest to the young James Joyce, James Joyce at the age of 22. Is haunted by this poem. So that's set in 1904, and this poem is going through his mind. Particularly the first three lines of the second stanza, and no more turn aside and brood upon love's bitter mystery. for Fergus rules the brazen cars. And Stephen's mother was haunted by those lines also. She's recently died at the time that Ulysses begins. She's been dead for a few months, and he's thinking about her. And there's a later scene where Stephen Dedalus, it all takes place, just to remind you that Ulysses all takes place in a single day. And later that morning, Stephen Dedalus in the library meets one of the members of the Rhymers Club, who was someone that Joyce knew as a young man. So remember, the Rhymers Club was the poets of the 1890s, whom we talked about last time. And Wilde was part of that. And Yeats was part of the Rhymers Club too, but there were these decadent poets of the 1890s. And one of them in this book, but whom we haven't talked about, George Moore, actually appears in Ulysses as a character. And you can feel 20th century literature. We're at the end of the Victorian age, and 20th century literature is beginning. One of the great anthologies, just again to say this parenthetically, one of the great anthologies of Kipling's poetry was edited by T.S. Eliot. Came out, I think, in 1949. And so Eliot, who's as far from Kipling as you can imagine, nevertheless, was an editor of Kipling's and was fascinated by Kipling. I wanted to, we don't have that much time with Yeats, but Yeats as a stylist is maybe the most mysterious stylist ever. That his poems are that hard to read. Some are, but none are really hard to read. But it's just his sense of, something we talked about a little bit two classes ago when we were looking at the two versions of A Cradle Song. And just his sense of, how it's okay not to go with that, with the more obvious meter of the earlier version, but just to push against that because it's better, because it works better. Not that the words are better, but that everything that's poetic or prosodical about it somehow works better with the tweaks that he makes. And you can see something like that here in... Any other poet would worry about repeating the word brood at the end, in line six, the end of the first stanza, and then have it be in the next line too. Any other poet would be pulling out the thesaurus, and it would be, and think about hopes and fears no more, but nah, it's think about, and that's going to ruin the meter. Saturate yourself in, just all the things. You would just look for a synonym for brood. But what Yeats is doing is he's getting that sense of don't brood as a kind of brooding just because the poem kind of broods over the word brood. And it's not that he said, yes, I will make this poem brood over the word brood. It's just that his ear was so amazing and that he could feel just how having that word repeated just got exactly the effect that he wanted. So essentially that's the thing to know about Yeats is his diction, his language is as subtle as poetic diction and as poetic language can get. I did want to show you that. I also wanted to show you at least one poem by Michael Field, the one called Cyclamens. This is page 599. Before you get there, what do you know about Michael Field before you look? Yes.
It was the pen name of a pair of writers, an aunt and a niece.
Who were also...
lesbian, and may or may not have had sexual relationships with each other, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, no, that's very here, and why do you think they didn't? Why the may not have?
I didn't want to be too... I guess I wanted to be facetious about it.
It was pretty clear that they were a couple. An aunt and a niece... The aunt's sister is the mother of the niece, but she was an invalid, so her aunt took care of her. And they were a couple, and they published under the name, you know, so that's, in some cultures, that's obviously incest, and in others, it isn't. They published under the name Michael Field, and they were really admired and well-known until they outed themselves, and then suddenly no one liked their poetry anymore, except Robert Browning, who loved their poetry and called them the sapphic poets, the sapphic couple, and he always admired them. And they, or Michael Field, wrote an elegy for Browning when he died. Anyhow, they are really interesting, and they have come to be of interest to queer theorists over the last 20 years or so. This is the one set of poems that are collaborative. That we're reading. There's collaboration in all poetry. There has to be. You know, people hear a draft of your poem and they say, it's really good, but I'm not sure I like the last line, and there's tinkering and so on. But these are explicitly collaborative. You can't say, for example, if you know the Wordsworth poem, We Are Seven, the first stanza of that poem is actually written by Coleridge, even though it's all of it's ascribed to Wordsworth. Because Wordsworth took it. He said, yes. Coleridge said, why don't you do this as a first stanza? And Wordsworth could say yes or no. It was his poem, so he said yes. So lots of poems are mildly collaborative, but it also matters, and we think of them as being by the poet who thought that the poem finally said what they wanted to say. And, you know, it's true of poetry in any language. You're collaborating with a language that is not yours to begin with the meanings of words and resonances and overtones of words that they already have before you start writing. The strangest thing about poetry is how much of it is the assemblage of ready-mades. More than any of the other seven classic arts, probably. But here, for this anthology, they have equal billing, and they are creating this poet named Michael Field. A lot of their poems are about this experience of being. Having this intense and, let's say, an experience not strongly approved by society, which is what we were talking about with respect to Wilde on Monday as well. But if you look at Cyclamens, and if you remember, which you may not, but which you will for the exam, the John Clare poem about the winter spring. Do people remember we did that in class? So in a way, this is similar to that. They are terribly white. Do people know what cyclamens are? Anyone? Flowers. Usually pink or red, but they are terribly white. There is snow on the ground and a moon on the snow at night. The sky is cut by the winter light. That's a great line. The sky is cut by the winter light. Yet I, and there's, you know, who's I there? Yet I, who have all these things in ken, am struck to the heart by the chiseled white of this handful of cyclamen. So here are these white flowers. And outside, everything is white. There is snow on the ground and a moon on the snow at night, and the sky is cut by the winter light. So that's a vivid idea of the sky being cut by light. The sky is cut by the winter light. Yet I, who have all these things in can, am struck to the heart, not by the snow on the ground, not by the moon on the snow at night, but by the chiseled white. Chiseled, strange word to use about flowers. The chiseled white of this handful of cyclamen. So it's, you know, if you get interested in Michael Field, he, they would be a really good poet, poets to be interested in. Fascinating. And pretty sure I talked to her about this, and I think she was writing on Michael Field at some point, that Terry Castle was working on him. But offhand, I'm not sure. But Terry Castle's a really, really interesting critic, too. Okay, let us now look at Houseman, in particular the poem called "Oh, Who Is That Young Sinner?" And let's see where that is. Poem 548. So page
613.
Thank you. Houseman, you may or may, do people know who he is? Is he a poet that you're at all familiar with?
The name's familiar, but I couldn't tell you from there.
Okay, so he has a poem not in this book. I'm interested in the poems Rick's picked. I'm interested in why he picked them. I think he was looking for poems that were less well known by Houseman. And he does that from time to time. Houseman is famous for a comic poem called "Terence, This Is Stupid Stuff." Terence was his kind of poetic name for himself. So this is, his friends are complaining to him about how his poems are all so melancholy. And so they say to him, "Terence, this is stupid stuff. You eat your vittles fast enough. So why are you writing these melancholy sad poems when, you know, you really like your food, your drink, you have a good time in life. So why all this stupid poetry?" And one of the things they say to him, famous line is, "And malt does more than ever Milton can to justify the ways of God to man." So the idea is, you know, if you need some reason to think that God is not entirely evil, which is what Paradise Lost is allegedly going to try to give you. That's its official. People know that, right? That it's okay. So the official Paradise Lost describes itself as there so that Milton can justify God's ways to men. That's the line he uses. It's line 22 of Paradise Lost. It's the line that he uses at the end of the introduction, where he says what the poem is about. The poem is about what? Man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe with loss of Eden. And he says, and in this poem, I'm going to try to justify God's ways to men. Where God's ways seem to be, they ate an apple and now most of us are going to hell. So is that justifiable? And Milton says, officially in this poem, I'm going to try to justify it. Is he really trying to do it? In my opinion, no. In the opinion of a lot of people, no. But in the opinion of some people, especially C.S. Lewis, yes. But that's a famous line, justify God's ways to men. E. Cummings has a little poem that goes, did you all read E. Cummings when you were younger? Do you still read him? Yeah, okay. Sorry?
I did when I was younger. I haven't in a while.
Yeah.
I famously had an English class in my senior year of high school where we read the E. Cummings Carr poem, and the teacher was unaware of the actual meaning behind the E. Cummings Carr poem. He like took it literally as a car, and we were like, "That's great. We're all 18, and we're looking at each other like, cool, cool, cool."
Yes. All right. Nice. Yeah, he has another poem called My Sweet Old Etc., where the word etc. means, you know that one, means a bunch of different things in the course of the poem. At any rate, he does have a poem that goes, when any mortal, even the most odd, can justify the ways of man to God, I'll think it strange that any normal mortal cannot justify the ways of God to man. So this idea of justifying the ways of God to man or to men, people really seized on that in Milton. So Houseman's friends are telling him, the very fact that booze exists does more than Milton can to make you think God might not be all that bad. Because if you were really all that bad, you wouldn't be able to get drunk. And that's kind of like the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, right? You're alive now, drink, which is the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam reduced to a single sentence. Not the way Fitzgerald would have reduced it, but still. Houseman was a really interesting person. He's maybe the most erudite classicist of his time. He was a professor of poetry at Oxford, but he didn't get a position as a professor for quite a while because for reasons unknown, but through some crisis, he flunked his exams when he graduated college. And he ended up working in a patent office, but wrote a lot of reviews of books and classics and eventually got this job. And he could have been, Professor Latin. He could have been Professor Greek. He was really, really good at both. Famous line in one of his book reviews, a hilarious line about a new book, was, "This book fills a much needed gap." So think about that for a second. Because it sounds like praise, but it's the opposite of praise. This book fills a much needed gap. So it's just a suffocating, yeah, see? It's like you hear the rhetoric and you think, okay, yeah, good review. No, really bad review. He has another review where this poor person, worked really hard, wrote this book. Houseman reviews it, finds three counterexamples to the thesis, like, immediately. And then he has this great line at the end of the review, which is that 3 minutes thought should have sufficed to indicate to the author the implausibility of his claim. But thought is irksome, and 3 minutes, a long time. Which is true. I mean, I sometimes think it's true. Thinking for 3 minutes, that's pretty hard. So I'm glad Houseman felt that as well.
Will something like that ever happen at any of our dissertation defense?
Yeah, that's what I want to know.
You mean that we say things like that at your dissertation? No.
Okay, well, thank God.
No.
I've certainly had papers like that where I got to the end and I was like, I'm pretty sure if you think about it, I'm wrong.
Yes.
Yeah. Too late.
Yeah.
So, at any rate, take a look at the poem called Oh, Who Is That Young Sinner, page 613. It's a Kipling-esque poem, a little bit like Danny Deaver, but comic. Again, I'll go through it quickly. Oh, who is that young sinner with the handcuffs on his wrists? And what has he been after that they groan and shake their fists? The they are the people who are angry at the young sinner. And wherefore is he wearing such a conscience-stricken air? Oh, they're taking him to prison for the color of his hair. 'Tis a shame to human nature such a head of hair as this. In the good old time, 'twas hanging for the color that it is, though hanging isn't bad enough and flaying would be fair for the nameless and abominable color of his hair. So he's being taken to prison because of the color of his hair and used to be hanged for having hair color like that, but no more. Oh, a deal of pains he's taken and a pretty price he's paid to hide his poll, that is his head, or diet of a mentionable shade. But they've pulled the beggar's hat off for the world to see and stare, and they're hailing him to justice for the color of his hair. Now 'tis oakum for his fingers and the treadmill for his feet and the quarry gang on Portland in the cold and in the heat. And between his spells of labor in the time he has to spare, he can curse the God that made him for the color of his hair. Now, if you notice, it's written 1895, published 1937, after Hausmann's death, published by his brother Lawrence. He said he could publish it after his death, but not before. And Lawrence, when he published it, said that he said I could publish it. Why would he not have wanted this published in his lifetime, do you think? And it's not because it's a bad poem. That's not the right answer.
Is it because something happened that brought about the subject of the poem and he didn't want to be ridiculed for having it?
Well, so do you think that there are people who were arrested for the color of their hair in England in 1895? Look at that person with red hair.
Oh, is it like Irishman?
Well, it's in fact a particular Irishman.
Gotcha.
Who might that be in 1895? Who is being arrested for a biological trait and set to hard labor. And even though he might have wanted to keep this trait hidden or might not have, whom we talked about on Monday.
Oscar.
Yeah, this is a poem about Oscar Wilde.
Oh, okay.
Who was Irish. Yeah.
But I didn't know that. Yeah. Also, I thought, I definitely didn't know he had red hair.
I don't know that he did have red hair, but that's not why he was arrested.
Yeah. The idea is that it was something just about him.
Yeah, yeah.
It was that, stupid that it's such a big deal.
Yeah,
yeah. So just take
very
color.
Very progressive, honestly, this poem.
Very what?
It's a very progressive poem.
Yes. Yeah, so just take the color of his hair as for his sexual orientation.
And also for all the talk of people not being able to talk about it, he couldn't even publish a poem that alluded possibly to that.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so to hide his poll or diet of a mentionable shade is, you know, to have a beard in the queer sense of having a beard.
Mm-hmm.
So that people won't know that you're gay. Mm-hmm. Which Oscar Wilde, the question is, when the issue for Wilde when he was accused of being a sodomite was if he didn't, his friends told him, just let it go. But if he doesn't complain about it, then it's going to be, see, he doesn't deny it.
Yeah.
And so he was put in a really tricky spot, Wilde was. And as Jeff said, he was put in that tricky spot partly because he wasn't discreet in a time when you could be in serious trouble. But just, yeah, notice this, that 'tis a shame to human nature, say the, do you know the term bien pensant? Basically, that's the people who agree with society. It literally means the well thinkers or the think wellers might be a better translation. Those who think that basically society's right and they run things pretty well and you should just agree with the social attitudes of those around you and don't say gay. So they're the kinds who will say, I don't know, just imagine Ron DeSantis reading this poem at his inauguration. 'Tis a shame to human nature. What is being gay? Such a head of hair as his. In the good old time, 'twas hanging for the color that it is. So back in the day, he would have been executed for being gay. Though hanging isn't bad enough and flaying would be fair for the nameless and abominable color of his hair. So basically, color of his hair, now you can see that it's code. One reason that Hausmann didn't want to publish is not only that you couldn't be seen defending Wilde, but that Hausmann was gay. And he, unlike Wilde, was extraordinarily discreet about it. But he, when he worked in the patent office, he fell in love with one of his co-workers, a man named Moses Jackson. And it was kind of a painful, lifelong experience that he had. So knowing that, take a look at the poem 545 on the previous page. So again, this is another poem not published until he died by his brother. So written around 1893, but not published for 43 years after that. But it's officially, you know, if you didn't know, and that's part of the point, is if you didn't know, you would think it was written to a woman. That is, it's the kind of poem that we've seen, well, maybe we haven't seen many of, but that Victorian readers have seen thousands and thousands of. There are, it's not perfectly ambiguous, because there is a suggestion that the addressee is, if you didn't know, if you found this poem in a bottle and you knew nothing about its writer except that he was male, there's a little bit of evidence that would push you to think that the addressee was female. Not much, that's the point. It's almost entirely ambiguous, but not quite. And but it's ambiguous enough that it, again, gives him, that ambiguity allows him to write this poem without it being perfectly obvious that it's written to another man. So, because I liked you better than suits a man to say. So that's why you might think that it's addressed to a woman, because it suits a man to say something or not to say something. But that would be, you're not in that position. I'm in that position. I'm the man. You're not. That at least is a very slight suggestion there, which gives him, allows him to cover his hair so that you don't see its true color.
But wouldn't that line make it sound more leaning towards it's written for a man, though?
Well, that's, once you know, yes.
Oh, okay.
But
that's true.
Yeah. So if you didn't know, it's extremely plausible as a heterosexual poem, or a heteroerotic poem. And it's just like, you know, I should be a man and I shouldn't just be all gushy about you. And that's what's unsuitable about it. And, but where it's unsuitable in Victorian England in 1893 is to like another man. So it's exactly what you're saying. As soon as you see it, you see it. As soon as you see, what are the two dress colors? Black and red, and all right, anyhow.
White and gold.
Yeah. So yeah. Once you see it one way, yeah. It's like clearly there, but until you see it, it's not.
Yeah.
So because I liked you better than suits a man to say, it irked you, and I promised to throw the thought away. So he said something to him, but Moses Jackson was too anxious, was not responsive enough. It's not quite clear what happened. So, to put the world between us, we parted stiff and dry. Goodbye, said you. Forget me. I will. No fear, said I. So he's defiant. So no, I'm not the person for you. Okay, fine. He sustains his dignity, as people do in breakups, right? I'm sure you haven't experienced this yet. And then he goes on, if here where clover whitens the dead man's knoll you pass, and no tall flower to meet you starts in the trefoiled grass, halt by the headstone, naming the heart no longer stirred, and say the lad that loved you was one that kept his word. So, yeah.
I have a question about the word in this one.
Yeah.
Could we possibly see the first stanza in a more, perhaps, literal light?
Go on.
Because I don't know how I knew, I don't know how I know this, and forgive me for knowing this, but...
forgive you for knowing this. Okay.
Condoms were invented in 1858.
Uh-huh.
Just 40 or so years after this poem was...
That's such unforgivable knowledge. Before the poem was written.
Yes.
Yeah.
So is it possible that we could take that line in a more literal way of I'm literally throwing the thought away as in I'm literally throwing away the thing that I was thinking about? Being like...
So not if it were addressed to a male, because the idea of protected sex... is 1980s because of HIV. So if it were to a woman, you could maybe make that argument. What does it get you to make it?
I'm not sure. Something about throwing the thought away, throwing away the thought that you wish you didn't have,
mm-hmm.
the thought that could literally ruin your life.
Okay.
If it got out.
I see. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the thought is, I think you're onto something important there, because the thought is clearly one that if thought seems to be a very weak word for, let's call it, erotic obsession. But what it actually means is something like sexual fantasy. And if the sexual fantasy were known, if its vividness to him were public, if it were equally vivid to others, that would be really, really terrible. So by just calling it a thought and just, throw that thought away. Yeah, go ahead.
I feel like it's a common queer experience too. Like, people, I feel like in my experience with people I've talked to, it's a lot of, it's just, you kind of realize it and you're like, I don't want to deal with that thought. And I'm just going to, like, you really do try to, like, diminish it because then you don't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
Especially when she's talking about it here. I don't know. It made sense to me that was the word that you would use.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, never mind. It was just a thought I had. Huh?
Yeah, just a thought, no big deal.
Never mind.
Yeah. But, the idea that you throw a thought away makes it bigger than, in a way, you want to admit that it is. You know, it's, I can throw that thought away, but wait, what do you mean? Why are you even thinking about throwing a thought away? Like, that makes it just the very rhetoric that seems to be trying to downplay it actually upplays it. And I think that's what you were responding to in the dynamic of the poem. So that's really neat. But at any rate, this is like when you were old. That is, I'll be dead. And you'll look at my headstone. And it will name the heart no longer stirred, no longer fantasizing about you, no longer feeling erotic desire for you. And when you do that, say the lad that loved you was one that kept his word. Yeah.
So the implication here is that it's impossible to throw the thought away until you actually die. So it sticks with you in your life in silence and then...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But nothing comes of it. Yeah.
Yeah, nothing comes of it, but he's saying... I mean, is that going to be true for the next 36 years or 43 years? No, but it is you want me to shut up, and I will, I promise I will, I'll never mention this again, and when you see my gravestone 30 years hence, you can say I kept my word, because now I'm silent for good. So it's a way of saying, and again, you don't have to read. I'm saying you should know, just, and as soon as you see it, you know how clearly homoerotic it is. But you don't have to read it as a homoerotic poem. On the other hand, he felt people probably would, even if they knew nothing about him, which is why he wouldn't let it be published in his lifetime. It's interesting to see what he thought would be too revelatory, and who is that young sinner? Too revelatory. This poem, too revelatory. People would get what it was about.
I noticed that they're all published in different years, and there wasn't just like a New Houseman book immediately published when he died. But like, was it when some of these poems were published? Was it sort of a revelatory moment for the community?
I think after he died, there was a revelatory aspect to it. He was a really he was rightly, and that's one of the reasons I gave you these poems, he was rightly regarded as just a really intense and powerful poet. And the fact that he was gay was something that, you know, unlike Wilde, it was something that he was very, very careful to keep hidden from all but a very, very tiny number of people. But as I say, he was willing to have that fact known after his death. And he sympathized with Wilde just for that reason, because look what happened to him, and look at the hard labor that he had to perform. So it's the book that he's famous for is a book called A Shropshire Lad. And Shropshire is a place in England where, in fact, Houseman had never been. But he imagined it as an idyllic place. And let's look. So look at the poem called De Fugere Nives, which is the second poem on... You can't tell which is page one. The second poem on the page that is page one, because it begins with a title, on Wenlock Edge. De Fugere Nives is a poem by Horace, the Latin poet, from the few decades before the current era. And Houseman was a very, very stiff lecturer. And you know, he would go in, he would give his lectures, he would leave. They were chock full of information, people described his lectures as being chock full of information and, you know, really interesting facts. But he was not a dynamic speaker, and he took his job as a lecturer very seriously. That is, that he was the authority giving knowledge, imparting knowledge. But one lecture that he gave was on the Horatian Ode that this is a translation of. And he gave the lecture about 15 seconds, or maybe it was longer, maybe it was about a minute before the hour ended. He looked up and he said, "I think this is the most beautiful poem ever written," and he burst into tears and rushed out. And he found Horace's poem just extraordinarily powerful and moving. So this is his translation of it, which is one of his great poems, is the translation. We're coming to the end of things, but let's have people read again. So, Julia, why don't you read the first stanza?
The snows are fled away, leaves on the shaws, and grasses in the mead renew their burn. The river to the riverbed withdraws, and altered is the fashion of the earth.
Great.
The nymphs and graces, three, put off their fear, and unapparel in the woodland play. The swift hour and the brief prime of the year say to the soul, thou was not born for I.
Okay, so let's just stop there for a second. So As I say, diffugere nives means the snows are melting, and that's they're the first two words in Latin. So he translates that as the snows are fled away. So what's happening? What time of year is it?
Spring.
Springtime, yeah. And everything is getting better. The river is coming back. It's not just marshy and all over the place, but it's turning into a river again. The grasses are renewing their birth. And now we get these mythological figures, the nymphs and graces, are back outside, not fearful. And then, maybe a couple of unexpected lines, the swift hour and the brief prime of the year say to the soul, thou wast not born for I. So what does that mean? What is spring saying to the soul? So what does I mean there? Let me just ask that.
I read it as this, but I also know that I am not reading that correctly necessarily. I'm guessing.
Yeah, so it actually means forever.
Okay.
Right. So then this is very much a getting in that playtime during spring and being rewarded while you can.
Yeah.
So this is, it's funny because it's in, like, you weren't born for forever, but these are immortal beings.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's spring, which is a time of joy and hope and renewal and rebirth, except to Horace and to Houseman. What all that joy and renewal and rebirth are saying is, yeah, it's really beautiful and it's brief. And it reminds you that you're going to die. So it's the opposite of what you would think, which is spring makes us forget that we're going to die. Unless it's like this. But this is a reminder. Spring becomes a reminder that you're going to die. Quinn, read the next quatrain.
Fall follows rest, hard on the heel of spring. Tread summer sure to die, for hard on hers. Comes autumn with his apples scattering, then back to wintertide when nothing stirs.
Yeah, so spring reminds you that winter's coming. Shelley's famous poem, The Ode to the West Wind, ends with, it begins, a wild west wind, thou breath of autumn's being, and says that the wind is coming, autumn is here, everything is being destroyed, I'm going to die, things are terrible, but it ends. The fifth, it's made up of five sonnets, and the fifth sonnet ends, oh wind, if winter comes, can spring be far behind? But here, we're getting the opposite. If spring comes, can winter be far behind? So, back to wintertide when nothing stirs. Irina.
But oh, whatever the skylit sessions mar, moon upon moon rebuilds it with her beams. Come we where Tullus and where Ancus are, and good Aeneas, we are dust and dreams.
So, whatever happens, there's moonlight. And when we go to where the dead are, to the land of the dead, so this is Horace citing mythological figures, but not only mythological figures in the poem, but here mythological figures. When we get to where those figures are, it becomes clear that what we are made of is dust and dreams. Red?
Torquatus, if the gods in heaven shall add the morrow to the day, what tongue has told? Feast then thy heart for what thy heart has had, the fingers of no air will ever hold.
Okay, so he's talking to his friend and he says, who knows if we'll live another day? What God has told, whether the gods will add another day to our life. So what you have to do is feast now. Feast your heart. For what thy heart has had, the fingers of no air will ever hold. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. descendants will never experience what you've experienced?
Yeah, that there are things that you can have in the world. You can try to spend a lot of time getting rich and piling up goods, and then your heirs will inherit those. But human experience is completely your own. So what you should do is feast your heart, for that's something that is going to disappear with you forever, but that you can have right now. Samantha.
When thou descendest, once the shades among, the stern sighs and equal judgment are, not thy long lineage nor thy golden tongue, no nor thy righteousness shall friend thee more.
So, quick paraphrase.
When you die, none of it's going to matter.
Yeah, when you die, none of it's going to matter. Once you're among the shades, nothing about who you were, how important you were on Earth, is going to matter. Sophia.
Can you pronounce the names of the students? Oh,
sorry, I thought you were going to say I was mispronouncing your name all semester long, too. Like Irina and Aileen, as I will now remember forever.
The last week of the semester.
Julia. Hippolytus, Theseus, Pirithoas.
Yeah. I've already forgot how you said the first of those.
Okay, don't worry about it.
May hopes Hippolytus the pure stain. Diana stands for nothing, he must stay. And Theseus lives.
Pirithoas.
Pirithoas in the chain, the love comments cannot take away.
Okay, so thank you. Beautifully written. Beautifully read. Hippolytus, when he dies, he may be pure, a completely pure figure. He is the victim in a famous tragedy, Phaedra. He's completely pure. He's killed. Are you doubting it?
Phaedra's the victim.
What?
Phaedra's the victim.
Maybe.
You mean because she kills herself?
No. I think that's the least.
She falls in love with Hippolytus.
Yeah.
Are you talking about Racine now, or are you talking about...
Oh, I'm talking about Racine's.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, no. I'm talking about Euripides.
Oh, okay.
Actually, no, I should have said the Euripides play is actually called Hippolytus, but it's about Phaedra and Hippolytus.
Yeah.
No, you're right, in Racine.
Yeah.
So Hippolytus dies because... despite being pure, Diana is the goddess of the hunt, and because the reason she spends her time hunting is that she doesn't spend her time. All right, know the story about Actaeon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, what happens to Actaeon?
He was hunting, but he accidentally saw Diana bathing.
Yeah, why is she so pissed?
What?
Why does that piss her off so much?
Because she's also the goddess of chastity.
Thank you. That's, yeah. Because she's the goddess of chastity.
Yeah.
So Diana steads him nothing. He's completely chaste. He's pure of stain. But so what? Diana doesn't help. Diana steads him nothing. He must stay. That is, in the underworld, in the realm of death. And Theseus leaves Pirithoas in the chain. So do people know about Theseus and Pirithoas? So it's another myth about Theseus tries to save his best friend from Hades, but fails. And just the last line, it's a little bit like this book fills a much needed gap. At first you think it means the opposite of what it means. So Theseus leaves Pirithoeus in the chain, the love of comrades cannot take away. And you just kind of parse it, I think. I mean, tell me if you do this, but you kind of parse it as... the love of comrades can't be taken away even by chains. But it means the opposite of that. That
cannot unchain you.
Yeah, that even love can't unchain you. And obviously here it's same-sex love again. He's translating literally what Horace... I mean, not literally, but accurately what Horace says. Yeah, this is a version, you could say, of the poem we just read as well, that love is not triumphant here. And that is, I think, why Houseman broke down. What's being described here is not what poetry often describes, which is how love is triumphant in one way or another. When you are old and gray, take this book down and remember that one man loved the pilgrim soul in you, and that memory will give you some compensation for the fact that you're old and gray and that those times are over. And in fact, that compensation is a compensation that you can have right now by having that melancholy be present between us at this moment. So going back to the Yeats poem. But here, this is, Horace is, with the possible exception of Virgil, Horace is the saddest of Roman poets. And that's what Houseman was responding to in him. Let's look at, do we have time for this? We do. Let's look at the poem at the end of that page, very famous also, another springtime poem. Loveliest of trees, let's just do these two quickly, even if we don't say much about them. Loveliest of trees, the cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough and stands about the woodland ride wearing white for Eastertide. So it's springtime, the cherry is in blossom, Eastertime. Now, of my 80, 20 will not come again. So how old is the speaker?
70.
No, of my 80, so 80,
70?
No. 50? No. 20 won't come back. So of the 70 years that you're allotted according to the Psalms in life, of the 70 years that you're allotted in life, 20 are gone. Mm-hmm. So how old is he?
20.
Good.
No, sorry.
Yeah. So he's 20, just kind of like us, right? look, when you are old and weary, of my 80, 20 will not come again. And take from 70 springs a score, that is 20, it only leaves me 50 more. I'm only going to see 50 more springtimes. And since to look at things in bloom, 50 springs are little room. Not a lot of time to look at blooming things, 50 springs. But because of that, about the woodlands, I will go to see the cherry hung with snow. So he's going to go look at these white cherry blossoms everywhere because he's only got 50 years to do it. And they're just so beautiful. He's got to do it right away. There's possibly a little bit of Wildianism here in what's sometimes called Japanerie. Wilde was really interested. Lots of people in the 1890s were really interested in Japanese aesthetics. And if you can think of famous Japanese scroll paintings of cherries and cherry boughs and so on. So there's probably a little bit of that there. Let's quickly look at this last poem on Wenlock Edge, which is a little bit like Yeats, but maybe backwards, and gives you a sense of his classicism. So Wenlock Edge is a place in England. Reckon's a river. On Wenlock Edge, the wood's in trouble. His forest fleece, the reckon heaves. The gale, it plies the saplings double, and thick on Severn snow the leaves. I'm sorry, reckon is the mountain. Severn is the river. So it's a very windy day. 'Twould blow like this through holt and hanger when Uricon the city stood. So Uricon is a Roman city. That was there 2,000 years earlier. 'Tis the old wind in the old anger. But then it threshed another wood. Then, 'twas before my time, the Roman at yonder heaving hill would stare. The blood that warms an English yeoman, the thoughts that hurt him, they were there. So 2,000 years ago, there was a Roman sitting and looking at the same weather, the same wind that I'm looking at now. There like the wind through woods in riot, through him the gale of life blew high. The tree of man was never quiet, then 'twas the Roman, now 'tis I. The gale, it plies the saplings double, it blows so hard, 'twill soon be gone. Today, the Roman and his trouble are ashes under Uricon. So someone stood here 2,000 years ago and had the same feelings I'm having now. And it's all about transience, and that man's transience is also going to be my transience. So their ashes under Uricon, under the city, which is itself gone. And that's what I will be in 2023 as well. So there's the Houseman at his, when he's plangent, he's as plangent as you can get. And it's quite amazing. Really, really worth reading the book called A Shropshire Lad, or just getting any selection of Houseman's poems. Okay, I guess that's it. So thank you, and see you at the exam, which is the 10th, which would be a week from today, right? Today's Wednesday.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, good. See you there.
Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you all. Thanks very much.